This is KUT
Austin.
Stop. This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten. During October, creativity is on full display in Central Texas. There's the Austin Film Festival, the Texas Book Festival, the Austin City Limits Music Festival, and that's on top of the music, theater, dance, and arts always going on. That all might seem like obvious creativity, but there's also less obvious creativity, fresh thinking and new ideas generated in all kinds of jobs. The Randall B. McDonald Chair in Accounting at UT Austin's Macomb School of Business and his partners wondered if and how employees' creativity can be fueled. Dr. Steve Katchelmeyer and two researchers from the University of Illinois did a couple of studies and found that to get people to be more creative, they need incentive to produce lots and lots of ideas, even if they're only so-so ones, and then some break time away from it.
Basically, in a simple form, the question is, can you incentivize people to be creative? Now, you can incentivize people to work hard, and you can incentivize people to do a lot of routine things. But to be creative is a different animal in the sense that it doesn't necessarily respond to raw effort. I can't say, come up with a brilliant idea now. You know, here's $50, do it. You know, here's $100. And so it's difficult to get immediately stimulated to become up with a creative idea. So there's subtle ways around that. And believe me, we're not the first. I say we because this is co-authored research with Laura Wang and Michael Williamson at the University of Illinois. We're not the first to get into this arena. But we take more of an accountant spin on it in the sense that, you know, what can we motivate? And it turns out the punchline is that the simplest answer to the question, can you incentivize creativity, is yes, but it's not easy to do. You got to incentivize people to come up with a lot of ideas, wait, give them time to rest, and then they become more creative.
So I have to ask you to define a term before we talk more about this. You're saying creativity, creative ideas. What do you mean creativity? Because, you know, you're an accountant, so creative accounting is not generally regarded as a good thing.
No, we don't want to go there.
But actors' creativity is great. So what are you measuring when you're measuring creativity?
Well, I would certainly say it's closer to the actor definition than to the accounting definition. You know, creativity is not necessarily good. I mean, that's where the negative stigma of creative accounting comes in. So you can be creative in the sense of different and innovative to ill ends. There's no doubt about that. But we're thinking of creativity more in the sense of fresh, new, innovative ideas in a profession, and there's more and more of these and less of the routine ones, where you're paid and your performance and your job is based on thinking and judgment and coming up with creative solutions to your clients' problems rather than just routine tasks. Because let's face it, virtually every routine task out there is being automated or replaced by a machine or a computer. So what's left in today's economy is creative thinking and coming up with ideas. And that's the service economy where you pay people not just to do routine work, but to think. And so that's what we mean by creative.
So how did you go about studying this?
Well, it's hard to do because creativity in a real world takes weeks, months, sometimes years. Researchers don't necessarily have that luxury, and we also wanted the control of an experimental approach to the question. So in other words, we wanted to manipulate things. We wanted to change things, but hold everything else constant. And so if I'm interested in the effects of incentives on creativity, I got to try different forms of incentives. In what? In some simple task that I can control and do in a simple amount of time. So we had, consistent with a lot of psychology research, student participants do a task where they designed what I will call rebus puzzles. Okay. Everybody's seen these things. And so one of the most common ones that everybody has seen is the word man, M-A-N, and then a line underneath it, and then the word board below that. And the solution to that is man overboard. You know? And so that's a little bit cute, but everybody's seen those things. We did not have these participants solve these things. We had them create them, design them. Okay, here's 11 examples. Now go for it. What can you do? And in a 20-minute task, we said, you know, here's different ways that we're going to pay you. And so we tried paying people for the number of ideas they came up, no matter how creative they were. We tried paying people for how creative their ideas were. By the way, how we measure creativity, that's usually, how do you know whether it's creative or not? We have panels of raters. Let me just say that if figure skating is an Olympic sport, you can rate creativity too. It's subjective. But we had panels of raters with remote devices, and they would rate these things from 1 to 10 after the experiment. As long as they don't know the treatment conditions, it's a fair approach. And so we can see how creative they are. So again, getting back to the incentives, we tried paying people for quantity, paying people for creative ideas, and just giving them fixed pay. Here's $25. Thanks for coming. You don't need to do anything. We'd like you to do something, but there's not tied to your performance. And again, in a nutshell, what happens in these simple 20-minute tasks, people are no more creative or no less creative under any of these incentive conditions initially. The kind of the germ of insight in the latest research that's getting some attention in the press is that what happens when you bring people back later?
So what do you think it is about that time interval that led to what you found, that led to more creative ideas?
Yeah.
Both good and bad.
Interestingly, psychologists still debate that question. So nobody knows exactly what's going on, but I would think I'd be safe in saying it's not necessarily conscious thinking. It's not that you're spending all that time working more on the task. It's not additional time. It's just that things germinate in the subconscious. How often have you had a brilliant idea walking out of the shower in the morning? You know, so you struggle on a difficult problem. You didn't come to closure. You didn't reach a solution. You get a good night's sleep. You take a shower. Aha! Got it! You know, so it's that spark of insight. And again, that's not new. People have shown that before. But what we're showing at the margin is that you need to have incentives to get that creative juices going in the first place. So it's sort of a two-stage process. Work hard, then rest. And the rest lets things relax. I mean, creativity happens in the subconscious. You know, you get this inspiration. But inspiration isn't magic. You have to have the preparation to let that happen.
So how widely applicable would you say these findings are as far as workplaces and business and sort of outside an academic laboratory setting?
Well, one never knows exactly because there's only so much you can generalize a laboratory experiment. But I do see companies in the world. Google comes to mind as one where the Google employees work hard. You know, they have even some stress. I mean, they're expected to perform, but they also are encouraged to meditate and rest and take some time and do other things as well. And that might seem contradictory at first blush. Okay, what do you want them to do? Do you want them to work hard or you want them to rest? And the answer is both. And so I think cutting edge workforce technology is something where you don't necessarily choose between beating your employees with a stick and letting them rest and relax. And again, the beating with a stick is a bit of a strong metaphor, but the idea is you need the incentives, you need to work, you need the frustration even, but then you also need to take some time off.
You need the frustration. That's interesting, because I think most of us immediately regard that as a bad moment in the process.
Yeah.
I'm stuck. Something's going wrong, I'm not getting it, but you're saying that actually might contribute to the ultimate better outcome.
You bet. And I don't have proof of this, but we actually did ask our participants, how much did you enjoy this task? And somewhat interestingly, the ones who got quantity incentives enjoyed it less than the ones with fixed pay. And so just letting people relax and enjoy the task and do whatever you want, they enjoyed it more. They just didn't do as well. So, you know, again, it might not be what everybody wants to hear, but sometimes you have to experience that frustration. They call it work for a reason. You have to get to that point of discomfort, that point, I'm just not getting it. I'm trying hard. Darn it, I'm doing the best I can. Then you rest, then you come back, and you're better off for it. But if you just rest and relax to begin with, you might have more fun, but you're not going to be as productive.
Is one way to look at this that creativity is sort of like a muscle? Because it seems like you're saying the folks who were told just come up with everything, good, bad, the quantity model, they wound up with the most creative ideas eventually, of course, intersected with incentive. Does that say that we just need to exercise that muscle?
That's
a
great analogy. Actually, I've never heard that one before, but you should be an academic professor. I'll bring you in on the next study. Absolutely. Now, this is, you know, I mean, we never thought of it with exactly that metaphor of a muscle that you need to exercise. But as I think about it, it fits. Absolutely. I mean, you need to, and we know that exercising isn't always fun when you do it, right? If you exercise well, you don't push it too far. You know, then you can, you know, cause damage to your body. So there's a limit to exercise. But good exercise pushes you to a point of challenge and then stops and lets you rest. And that's exactly what we're doing with that muscle called the brain. You know, we're pushing it to the point of, you know, come up with ideas. We're paying you for those ideas. We want you to produce. Okay, enough. Now stop. Now rest. Go relax a little bit. And what we did, we've tried this with 10 days of break between asking them initially and asking them eventually in just 20 minutes. And interestingly enough, they both seem to work. You know, it just takes some rest to let that exercise pay off in dividends later on.
So the amount of the rest didn't really impact things. It was just literally stopping, stepping back and starting again.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting, though. Other research has tried longer periods, and that doesn't work. Okay, that doesn't work. So simply saying, okay, we'll give you another couple hours to do this, that just adds to the frustration. Okay, there's a point in frustration where you need to stop. There's a point in frustration where you say, okay, I'm not getting it. I'm a little bit frustrated. My brain is hurting. Okay, I need to take a break. And you need to get to that point where it's frustrating, but then you do need to stop. And you're absolutely right, Jennifer. It's not necessarily how long that break is. We were interested. I mean, we tried to push the envelope. So in the latest study we did, we just took participants on a 20-minute walk. My colleague Michael Williamson said he felt like the mother duck. You know, he's escorting these participants. We told him it was part of the research, but just around the campus green space. We told them not to use their cell phones. We told them not to talk, but just to relax. Let's take a walk. Let's take a break. They came back, and the ones who were incentivized for quantity initially were more creative subsequently.
So what's coming to mind for me, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about how this work might intersect with another, I'll sort of say, conundrum that I'm thinking
okay.
about. And that's, I'm thinking of test takers specifically,
yes.
but I think it also apply the workplace. So if you're presented with a situation where you can't quite figure out the right answer, or you're not sure which option to choose,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes we're told, go with your gut, go with your first instinct. How might that relate to this finding, which is that germination, that rumination time can lead to good outcomes.
Well, I always do tell people to make like job decisions and even relationship decisions more with their heart than with their head. So that's a different issue in some sense. But, you know, I would say that it would be simplistic to say that you don't need to prepare. You know, you're faced with a tough decision, just do whatever, you know, go with your instinct. Best decisions are based on careful preparation. So, and that preparation, again, what this research would suggest is that it's not going to be enough. All right. So it's not going to be go study it, go come up with stuff, go do it, and then you're there. Okay. Then you need to take the break. And that's where I would argue the instinct comes in, because that instinct is now an informed instinct. It's an instinct with the background that gives you that preparation. And another analogy, if I may quickly add, is writing. Okay, people find it very difficult to write. We all know the concept of writer's block. I think this research has implications for that as well, in the sense that if you want to write well, first start writing. It's not going to be very good. But you need to force yourself to do that. You need to get going. You need to have that incentive, as painful as it is, as choppy as those words are, to write something. Then rest. Then come back. Maybe a day later, maybe a week later, maybe just a half hour later. Give yourself some rest. Come back, and those things you struggled with will seem all of a sudden easier. But unless you start initially with that product, forcing yourself to get it done, it's not going to happen.
That's such an interesting phrase you used, informed instinct.
Yes, yes.
I think a lot of people are, especially now that information is available so widely, I think we've gotten away a little bit from trusting our instinct or informed instinct. Like we don't believe we have it in ourselves, but we can search it, we can Google it, we can find we can find the answer externally, but a lot of it really still lies internally.
Well, it does. It does. But, and I'm glad you like the term informed instinct. I just made that one up on the fly. But if you think about the alternative of a clueless instinct, I'll take the informed instinct any day. So all I mean by that is that if we think go with your gut, go with your instinct, well, what if you have no idea what you're doing? No. That's not going to be an instinct I'm going to trust very well. So again, in some sense, if I may use the analogy of seeking a job, I think I would advise young people seeking their first job, do the research, do the homework, find out the pros and cons, then set it aside, then go with your instinct.
I don't want to imply that there are shortcuts around this, but are there ways to integrate your findings in situations where time is not available.
Yes, yes. I mean, again, you know, what do we do with airline pilots? We ask them to take a couple days break before they fly again. So you need that time to mentally recharge. But still, you're right. You know, so if I think about settings where it would not be good advice to say, oh, just try a few ideas, just brainstorm, just do whatever, you
right,
know,
in that
then come
moment.
Back later. If it's a surgeon at the operating table, that's not good advice, right? So you definitely, there are, you know, settings where you want to get it right the first time. And I don't have a magic solution to that, but I would say even in those settings, you need to come in fresh. So there's research on something psychologists call ego depletion, that, you know, our brain gets tired just like anything else. And we tend to make poorer decisions and weaker decisions and sometimes less ethical decisions towards the end of the day. We're tired. We want to go home. And so if you are in that setting of being a pilot or a surgeon or whatever, there's reasons we have regulations that say come in fresh. And at least if we can't give you the luxury of, you know, mulling it over for a day or two while you're on the operating table, at least we can give you the benefit of a fresh mind.
So do the results of this work make you want to explore an aspect of it further? Do you have plans to dig deeper into any of this research, or do you have another plan for your next experiment?
I will say it's been a lot of fun. You know, so, I mean, that's one thing I will say about research, and I tell our doctoral students this as well. Do something that's fun. But we've been doing this for more than 10 years, and I say we because I have co-authors on this work as well. And who knows? You know, I never say never. You know, but it is the case that, you know, just like, and I've never really thought about it this way before, but it took us 10 years to kind of crack the nut of even getting better creativity. What we found in our first couple of studies is that if you paid people, you gave people the right kind of incentives, they would be no worse in creativity, but no better either. And so the latest study is the first time we've actually seen improvement, but it's a delayed improvement. You know, what might come next, maybe feedback, maybe creativity impairs, you know, who knows? You know, there's certainly a richness to creativity in the workplace and in everyday life that I could spend the rest of my career doing this stuff. But I'm an accountant, so I better look at that auditing stuff, too, every now and then.
How did creativity find its way into accounting research?
Yeah, that's the question I probably get more than any other. And let me say, we all have this stereotypical image of accountants who produce dull reports that nobody reads after the fact. And some of that is true. I mean, there is an accountability element to accounting. Accountants do some sense of performance measurement, balance sheets, income statements of how people perform. But at the end of the day, at its root, accounting is measuring performance. And performance to me is not just an ex post, how did you do type of task. It's also before the fact, let me motivate you. You know, and usually in the accounting literature, the rule of thumb, the golden rule is, tell me how I'm being measured in my performance, and I'm going to tell you how I respond. And so people will jump to the bait in some sense and do however they're rewarded. But the reason an accountant is interested in this is, in some sense, if I measure your performance and my goal is to make you as creative as possible, can I align those two things? Because if people are going to be rewarded and get compensation based on, it turns out, for instance, just giving people more money for creativity doesn't work as well. And so it flies against the conventional wisdom that you get what you pay for. But accountants are interested in this because that's what we do for a living. We measure performance. And the more interesting part of that for me is not just the post-mortem, okay, how did you do? It's the before the fact, how could you do? And can I motivate you by telling you how your performance will be measured?
Dr. Steve Katchelmeyer is the Randall B. McDonald Chair in Accounting at the McComb School of Business at UT Austin. And Steve, we thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation.